So the talk tonight is on ethics without right and wrong, ethics without good and bad. If you would, just close your eyes for a sec and notice what reaction you have when you hear the word morality, when you hear the word virtue. Just notice what comes up. And, you know, just maybe popcorn style. What came up when you heard those words? Morality, ethics?
Censorship?
Uh-oh.
Things work better than other things.
Some things work better than others.
Integrity.
Happiness.
Judgment.
Rules.
So, you know, a pretty big range of responses. And a fair number of you, you know, uh-oh, rules, judgment, etc. My hope would be that maybe this can't happen in a two-hour group, but that maybe if you could feel ethics without a judgment, without rules, without right and wrong, but really as an expression of our love and care, that our ethics, that we wouldn't want to harm, and we would actually want to benefit if we were really in an open heart. And so the hope is that the Buddhist approach to ethics, which doesn't involve right and wrong, it doesn't involve judgment, you know, might feel a little lighter. And at the very end, I'm going to talk about the five precepts, which are the five basic guidelines that lay people follow in Buddhist countries on any retreat and also in life. And those are really, they're not rules. They're not commandments. They're guidelines. They're really ways to wake us up to our behavior. So when we notice that we're not acting aligned with one of the precepts, it can really be kind of a wake-up call, like, huh, what's actually going on inside, as opposed to what's wrong with me, or, oh, no, you know, I'm going to go to Buddhist hell. So in the Buddhist world, virtue, morality, ethics is seen very much as a thing of beauty and something that also creates happiness. One of you mentioned the word happiness, so maybe, just maybe, the associations with ethics could come more around love, happiness, care, as I guide you in reflecting on Buddhist ethics. So this is kind of the flavor of the way ethics are held within Theravada Buddhism, and this is from Acharya Dhammapala, who's a very famous ancient commentator on the Buddhist tradition. And he writes, "Virtue surpasses the adornments cherished by ordinary people, such as necklaces, diadems, and earrings. It is a supreme magical spell which wins the homage of deities. It is a highway leading to the great city of Nibbana. Virtue surpasses material wealth, for it cannot be confiscated by thieves. Virtue surpasses the achievement of beauty, for it can't be vanquished by the adversities of aging and sickness. As the foundation for distinguished states of happiness, virtue surpasses such distinguished dwellings as palaces, mansions, etc. In accomplishing the difficult task of self-protection, virtue is superior to troops of elephants, horses, chariots, and infantry." You can hear the ancient language and ancient metaphors. So this is the Buddhist flavor. And there's a lot that he said in there that I'll unpack. The flavor that we may have gotten if we grew up in a theistic religion, be it Christianity or Judaism or Islam, sometimes, not always, but sometimes there's a real flavor of sort of good and evil, punishment and reward, and some of those things you guys were saying, rules, judgment, etc. I don't look at the Bible very often, but I just was looking at it, and the language in here, you might have the same reaction. I mean, it was really striking to me, just about this is intense. Like ethics in the Bible. So here's the book of Genesis, and this is just after God found out that Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And so, and the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, "Where art thou?" Adam had, they had hid, they were hiding. Because they knew they were bad. And the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, "Where art thou?" And he said, "I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And he said, God said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, "The woman who thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." And the Lord God said unto the woman, "What is this that thou hast done?" And the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, I did eat. And the Lord God said unto the serpent, "Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle, and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all thy days in thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman," I think he's talking to Adam, "and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." Unto the woman he said, "I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." On and on it goes. Yikes. That's some intense stuff. You did something, God told you not to do it, so here's your punishment. Childbirth is going to really hurt, and the serpent's going to just eat dust and be lower than cattle. And so that is... Probably, that underlies all of our roots around feeling like ethics are really linked with really sort of judgmental thinking and really simple punishment and reward, black and white, good and evil kind of thinking. So the Buddhist flavor is very different. And the Buddhist flavor is basically that morality is a vehicle for happiness. Acharya Dhammapala said that in accomplishing the difficult task of self-protection, virtue is superior to troops of elephants, etc. Virtue is a self-protection. What's it protecting us from? What is virtue protecting us from? Suffering? Right, yeah. Someone else? No. You want to say more?
I don't think we suffer because we're attached to things. I don't think virtue protects us from that.
Yeah, virtue in and of itself. Virtue in the Buddhist tradition we would say virtue is not enough. We it doesn't necessarily undercut our attachment. But it is a protection from the suffering of remorse. If
or
we
guilt, right? As how do we distinguish from remorse?
Or guilt. And we can talk about the difference. There is a difference. It's a protection from sitting on the cushion and you're just minding your own business, trying to follow your breath, and then you remember that thing you said last week. Or in the heat of the moment, you know, you were really upset and you said something really unskillful. This is lawful. If you meditate, this will happen to you. Has it happened to you yet? Because if it hasn't, it will. It's just a law. The more you meditate, the more you're going to stumble across some unskillful thing you did, and you're going to feel bad. And hopefully you won't feel guilty, you'll feel remorseful. Guilt is a disconnect. Guilt is about me, and I'm bad and I'm wrong. Notice if the focus is here, I'm not even focused on the effects of my action, which may have caused difficulty for somebody. Remorse is actually based on empathy and not a focus on oneself, but a focus on just really seeing that, wow, that person experienced pain as a result of my actions. Ouch. And it hurts us. It hurts our heart. And we feel remorse. There's no shame in remorse. Remorse is like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to cause harm. So virtue is a protection against that. So the Buddha was very, very strongly emphasized ethical behavior as a protection for our own minds. And it's really maybe just as important as meditation in the path of awakening. And if you ever have any interest in the monastic side of Buddhism, just know you'll be signing up for over 200 guidelines for your behavior, precepts, about all the things that are skillful and unskillful to do. So the Buddha placed a huge emphasis on virtue as self-protection. Of course it's protection of others too, but we don't usually focus that as protection on ourselves. So, just if you would, just bring to mind someone in your life that you feel is just basically a good-hearted person. You know, a person that really, I don't know, maybe, you know, that felt sense of, oh, they wouldn't harm a flea, you know? Do you know anyone like that? Maybe it's yourself. When you think of that person, how are they doing? Are they happy? Are they unhappy? Not a rhetorical question. When you think of just a really good-hearted, kind, well-meaning person, you know, how are they doing overall?
Very happy.
Unconditionally happy. Generally, when we're happy, we don't want to harm. And conversely, think about someone, maybe a difficult person in your life that you feel is actually putting out unskillful things. And think about their overall well-being. How are they doing? Now, big generalizations, but generally, people who are causing a lot of harm are not like skipping around through the tulips, tiptoeing through the tulips, as the old song goes, right? Virtue really is very strongly related to happiness. It's protection from remorse, and that when we're really happy, we want to benefit. We don't want to harm. So all of the Buddhist precepts really are kind of guidelines for faking it till you make it. They are how you would act if you were really at your best, if your heart was clear, open, loving, kind, if you had self-love, if you had metta for others. You wouldn't want to harm. You just want to benefit. So the precepts are kind of like reminders of how we would act when we were at our best, and they're protections from remorse or guilt or feeling bad. So one of my teachers, Guy Armstrong, likes to say, that morality is built into the very fabric of the universe. If we're actually really focused on ending our suffering and benefiting others, we actually, in a joyful, loving way, want to harm. I mean, to not harm. I had a 50-50 chance of getting that right. Just a roll of the dice. That really, that life teaches us, if we really want to be happy and we really want to awaken, life is teaching us to avoid harming and to, as much as is possible, to help. So a famous Indian saint who came to Tibet and pretty much started Buddhism in Tibet, Padmasambhava, in the 8th century, has a very famous quote in Dharma circles. He says, "My view is as vast as the sky, but my attention to the law of cause and effect is as fine as a grain of barley flour." So that's kind of Tibetan language view, vast as the sky, for having realized this incredible spaciousness of mind. Unimpeded clarity, unimpeded wisdom. And where in a way nothing is born, nothing dies, there's no distinctions, it's this seamless being, you know, non-separation. So that's kind of the, you know, what awakening is like. And but he's saying, my attention to the law of cause and effect, meaning karma, is as fine as a grain of barley flour. So even though he's, you know, very free in his heart, he understands that what really determines our happiness is our actions and the accumulation of our actions. I don't want karma to be too mysterious. Karma is really the simplest way to think about karma. If we take away past lives and that very difficult part of it, really, karma is habit of mind. And our actions, the ones that we practice a lot, are the ones that we will continue to do a lot. So the mind greases its own skids. The more we practice aggression and anger, the easier aggression and anger becomes. The more we practice kindness, mindfulness, the easier it becomes. These are karmic things we do. And that's what really determines our happiness. And so the ethics around this are that when we're putting out harm, we are, just the inner harm of repeating aggression over and over, it has a karmic imprint of making the habit easier. And then we do the outer action of acting it out and causing outer harm, and that harms the person. And then in some way, some mysterious way, that comes back to us. So there's all these levels in which our actions have karmic effects. And because of that, because it's really our actions that determine our happiness, Padmasambhava says, my attention to my actions is as fine as a grain of barley flour. So this is deep. Hopefully light also. Your karmic actions, not a self, are controlling your happiness. That's a really, really huge thing to get. It's essentially our habits that determine how we react to things. Now, we can intentionally create new habits in the moment. We can do that all the time. But when some reaction comes, and you know, we don't generally tend to order up our difficult emotions or even our you know, pleasant emotions. We just find ourselves in the emotion. And I think I've used this example before, so just bear with me. But so if you're in the line at the bank, and you've got some place to get to, and there's 10 people in line, and you're like, and you have to make this deposit today, you're like, oh my God. So wait, what's the right reaction here? Is it you know, joy? Is it fear? Is it you know, restlessness? Oh, impatience, right. Okay, I'm going to feel impatient now. Right? We don't do that, right? We show up at the bank, we open the door, oh my God, and we're just impatient. What's making you impatient? Your habits. Pardon? Yeah, I wouldn't say you. I would say your habits. You're not sitting here ordering it up, oh right, impatient is the appropriate emotion. You're actually just, boom, impatient. And what is that? That's your karma. That's the habits of mind that you're in. That's what's making that happen. This is the Buddhist view of it. So we need to take a lot of care with our actions as an act of love, getting it that what really controls our happiness is not some self who can willfully, you know, order up the appropriate emotion at all times. That's not the way it works. The way it works is the reaction comes, and if we're lucky, we wake up to it. And then we have choice. Then we can make a difference. But until that moment, it's just our karma running us. So this is not to scare you. This is just to simply give you the Buddhist view of how our mind works. And based on this view, this is why attention to our actions is so important. So, ethics without right and wrong is all about getting real and all about getting that our actions don't just affect others, our actions affect ourselves. And Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. There's no outside. Karma isn't kind of internal. What's the word? Lawfulness, that we want to take care of our behavior because of how it affects us, not just because of how it affects others. There's not like a God out there that's going to punish us. Actions have their own rewards. The actions themselves are their own punishment and reward. Heaven and hell are not places. They're states of mind. This is really the Buddhist view of things. And you can actually hear contemplative Christians talk this way. People who aren't having some kind of literal interpretation of the Bible. That very much heaven and hell are not places. They're states of mind. So it's outside codes of behavior where the judgment and good and bad can really come in. And there are codes of behavior, the precepts, but we hold them more as not as good and bad, but as harm and, but in the context of harm and benefit. And the Buddhist words we use are skillful and unskillful. That takes us out of the good and bad. Because good and bad is really based on living up to some kind of exterior code outside of us. We don't need that in Buddhism because we're not a theistic approach. And harm and benefit, really, if you get down to it, are about nothing other than relationship. These are protections of our relationships. And so in this way, our ethics are very much about love. They're not about like, oh my God, I shouldn't do that. They're about expressing your love. That's what ethics are. No right and wrong needed. Not a moment of guilt needed. Remember that guilt is focused on you and what's wrong with you. It's not even focused on the relationship. So harm and benefit are focused on the effects of our actions and on relationship. So this is the ethics that So again, depending on what kind of interpretation you have of a theistic religion, if you have a more fundamentalist interpretation, you can be really scared. You're literally going to heaven or hell based on your actions. And then you do these things based on some abstraction that you don't even necessarily know about. And this is just my view. In my view, that disconnects us from the primary situation at hand, which is relationship, how we're getting along with each other, and harm and benefit. That's the real deal. Heaven and hell, I don't know. Do you know? I mean, you're going to have to take somebody's word for it. Do you know that from your experience? Just a cartoon to lighten it up a little bit. The devil is speaking to one of his assistants. Oh, this is really small. Saying, take away a few more parking spaces. I thought that was very appropriate for coming here downtown Boulder. Just, you know, that can really wreak havoc on us poor mortals, that we can just get so upset, you know, about not finding a place to park. Okay. So, where are we at time-wise? All right. I think this is a good place for a break. I'm going to talk more about just basic principles for non-dual and non-judgmental ethics. So, you know, kind of some of the bases. I've already kind of alluded to karma, but I've got a few others to unpack. And so let me just kind of pause here and just see if anybody wants to respond, input, questions, random facts.
Don't you think that there are some fundamentalist Buddhist traditions that actually do literally take those things like heaven and hell as places? I mean, I've been exposed to some. It seems like there are.
Yes, that's your experience. So
I think maybe we're overgeneralizing and saying that the Buddhist tradition.
Yes. This is an important point. I'm glad you said it. And I repeat questions for the mic because the mic doesn't always pick it up well. Yeah. The question's around, is it really, I mean, does Buddhism not also have a kind of fundamentalist element to it? And having been in Asia, you know, and studied there, yes, definitely. There's a fundamentalist approach, and you can certainly find this. So the key is that there is contemplative practice happening. Whatever the tradition is, it gets fundamentalist when it gets divorced from actual spiritual, mystical, contemplative practice. When it becomes sort of rules and ideas, as opposed to getting past our ideas about everything and into direct mystical experience. So yes, I'm glad you said that. There can definitely be a kind of fundamentalist hold on the Buddhist precepts, for instance.
Yes. When you said those two words before, morality and virtue,
yes,
something like that, the morality I felt more like something imposed from outside, and virtue as coming from more inside.
Mm-hmm. Just so the comment is that morality, in your take, really comes more from the outside, and virtue is more kind of internally driven.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those words would have very different flavors for you.
They did.
Yeah. Somewhat, you know, it's semantics. We all have our associations.
I think another word that comes to mind for me around this, when you mentioned ethics, is integrity. And it's one of those words that people so often have this association that it's something that's being levied on you from the outside, that you owe this to other people. Whereas really, or my experience with that has been, like you were saying, that it's more so for your own. When the word like integrity, and you think about it, it means wholeness. Mm-hmm. So if you're exhibiting integrity or taking steps in that direction, then you're exhibiting wholeness, which obviously you're going to benefit from yourself.
Mm-hmm. So the comment is that integrity is another way of holding ethics, that we're acting in our integrity, which is wholeness. So the implication being, if we are acting unvirtuously, unethically, we're actually not whole.
I mean, which I'm relating to happiness, like with what you're relating
yes.
to, you know, wholeness in that, or as one aspect of happiness, or vice versa.
So integrity very much relates to happiness. If we're feeling in our integrity, that's we're pretty feeling pretty good usually. Okay, we'll take a break. In theory, and this is a big generalization, maybe someone would know exceptions, but the death penalty would be really at odds with the Buddhist view of things. Because in the Buddhist view, people cause harm not because they're evil and benefit because they're good. People cause harm because they're ignorant. And if you're ignorant, you're redeemable. You actually, if you're evil, you're not redeemable. And so in an ethics based on good and evil, I guess you can have a society in which the death penalty exists, because you could just feel like the society that someone's not redeemable. I mean, I know that's not the only reason that advocates of the death penalty would say, but you have to have that belief in there. If you don't have that belief, you couldn't support the death penalty. So people harm out of ignorance, not out of badness. And that steers you, while still opposing harmful behavior and taking appropriate action against harmful behavior, knowing that it comes from ignorance ultimately can steer us towards compassion. We can oppose the action while having compassion for the actor. Because if a person is causing harm, it's very likely they're in a suffering place, they're causing suffering, and that suffering in some mysterious way is going to come back to them. So isn't that worthy of compassion? That, I mean, people who are causing harm out of ignorance are not in a good place. So, again, we can have compassion for an ignorant person who's only causing more suffering for themselves and others while still opposing the action. But how we hold the person's very different. That is a potentially redeemable person. That person is not evil. They're maybe very unskillful. Not saying you want to be around him or wouldn't want to protect yourself in any way you could. But we can still hold the person differently in our hearts. So Buddhism even believes in theory that mass murderers are redeemable. And there's a story of Angulimala, who was a renowned bandit in the time of the Buddha, and he had supposedly killed 999 people, and his 1,000th victim was about to be the Buddha. He wanted 1,000, and then he would feel complete, I guess. And he sees the Buddha walking through the woods, and he starts running towards him. And the Buddha miraculously doesn't change his pace. He just stays walking, but he's moving at the speed of sprinting. And this guy can't believe it, and he keeps following, and the Buddha keeps walking supremely fastly, and he can't catch him. And finally, Angulimala says, "Recluse, stop." And so the Buddha stops and turns around and says, "I have stopped, Angulimala, but you haven't." And, you know, Angulimala is stopped by that, and he bows down and says, "Teach me," and the Buddha teaches him, and he becomes a monk, and as in pretty much every story from the Pali Canon, then the person gets fully enlightened. So he became an arhat, even though he had killed 999 people. And when he went begging for food in the villages, he would be stoned by the people whose, you know, relatives were his victims, and he accepted it as his karma. You know, that's a story in the Buddhist tradition. So, go figure. I mean, if your karma is that bad, you can still get enlightened. That's go figure. So, who knows, is the story true or not? It's the view. It's the Buddhist view of things, that even mass murderers are redeemable. If you think of it this way, it's very hard to sit with yourself if you've caused a lot of harm. If you've ever done retreat, you know that stuff comes up. You do eventually face it. Even just in daily practice, you face stuff. And in a way, the more harm we've caused, the less at peace we are in our hearts, and the harder it is to awaken. Now, obviously, this story says it's possible. But I think you can really think of it this way, that just directly, we can all understand this. It is uncomfortable to sit down and stumble over something we've done. And just on a personal note, it's, you know, this is hard that this is my past, but when I was a kid, I was a bit of a bully, and I bullied my younger brother. I bullied a few kids at school. This would be like something I did that I thought was funny. I would tap a kid on the shoulder, and I would hold up a magic marker, and he would turn around, and I'd put a streak on his face. I was a fifth grade, you know, when I did it. But that, I mean, I did stuff like that as a kid. And, I mean, when that comes up on retreat, it's embarrassing because it's like so against how I want to be now. But when it comes up on retreat or in our daily practice, we know we're not that person now. I mean, I was a kid back then. But it comes up as if that's me doing that. And it hurts. I mean, it hurts to know that I was mean to my younger brother. And his best friend has told me at various times in my adult life, "You were mean." And it just hurts. I cannot take that away. That's how I was. It's not how I am, but it's how I was. It hurts. And this practice is one in which we don't get to escape how our minds are in this moment. It's a purifying practice. If these things come up in your practice, you will feel the pain of it. And actually, it's a really good thing. This is the better alternative. It's better that it comes up in your practice so that you can feel the pain of it and you can learn from it and you can feel the remorse. If it doesn't come up, that's like pain in our heart that is constricting us in some way. So I think this is the way you could really tie in virtue and benefiting others, not harming others, with our meditation practice. It really is upsetting to our ability to be present to have to reflect on the harm we've caused. So we can hold people with compassion, knowing if you've done really terrible things, imagine what it's like to be in that person's mind and body. It's brutal. That is a suffering, suffering person. Doesn't mean they're not dangerous, but they're suffering. And so this is the way we can hold it, and we can understand this just through our own practice. I remember once after a retreat driving past a prison and just feeling like, wow, just like I can't take back the bullying that I did as a kid, they can't take back whatever, you know, hardcore thing they've done. They have to live with that their entire lives. They cannot change that they've done that. So... So this is the first principle of ethics without right and wrong, that people harm out of ignorance. And ultimately, ignorance can be a source of compassion for us. We can hold others in compassion while, you know, hoping they accept the face the consequences of their actions. So the second principle, I've pretty much talked about this a lot, is that karma determines our happiness. Karma in the form of our mental habits. I don't want to make it mysterious. In a sense, our mental habits determine our happiness. And our actions are taking our mental habits and acting them out, and so it's making them even stronger. So the more we understand this, the more we want to avoid harming others, because we know we're harming ourselves in the process. So,
I have a question.
Yes.
So, how did you relate to that statement, harm out of ignorance? How would you relate this statement to that people harm out of their own woundedness very often? You say that those are related, that people in that case are ignorant of how their woundedness is affecting their behavior, or?
Yes. So, the question is, how to relate harming out of ignorance with harming out of woundedness. And woundedness would be something that would really make you ignorant about the present situation. If we're wounded, we're acting out of our own situation and projecting it out on the world. And that's ignorance. That's being lost in the past and not being present with the situation at hand. So... when we heal our woundedness, we don't do that anymore. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And again, so the third principle is that we replace good and bad with happy and sad. Just to make it rhyme. we take right and wrong, good and bad, which are judgmental codes for our behavior, and instead focus on the relational situation at hand and focus instead on harm and benefit. In Buddhism, we use the word skillful and unskillful for our actions, not good and bad. So I think I've unpacked that one pretty well already. If you're acting based on code, again, as I said, it disconnects you. An example would be the double yellow lines on the highway. We don't follow those just because it's a code. We follow those because if we cross the double line, we're going to harm ourselves and someone else. We don't need that there, but it helps. But it's secondary. We don't do it because, like, oh my God, I'm going to break the law if I cross those lines. We do it because of harm and benefit. we're going to harm ourselves and the other person. So that's the primary situation at hand. The codes can be helpful reminders, but they're not the real thing. They can disconnect us. We can actually not see the effects of our actions when we're doing something simply to live up to a code. Does that make sense? And especially when the codes we go into good and bad through our judgmentalism, then they completely divorce us from even relating to the other person. We just feel that we're bad, and then it's all about us. And that really doesn't work very well. That doesn't help us be very relational, because we're, again, not focused on the effects of our actions. So we don't need the codes. We need awareness. If we can really be with the effects of our actions in relationship, we don't need a code. We can just, like, see how another person's doing and engage in some kind of dialogue where we come to a better understanding. So this is not to throw out all the codes. We do need codes as reminders. And the Buddhism has the precepts. But let's remember, it's not about the codes. It's about relationship. That's what our ethics is about. Any comments?
Yeah. Where you talked about the double yellow line, one example of that would be you're driving down the road, you can see clearly there's no one coming, but there's a bicyclist on the side. You would cross the line, which is
right.
Illegal,
yes.
To do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. The comment is that we would actually break the law for harm and benefit. If we saw a biker, we would just cross the lines because we would realize that was the helpful thing to do. So, did I summarize that okay?
Perfectly.
Okay. All right. I'll just keep going if you don't have anything to say for yourself. So, the fourth principle is that really and truly, when we harm others, we harm ourselves. Because the belief that we're separate is an illusion. It's the cause of all our suffering. And... small note. I remember once on retreat, this hall was very quiet, and a woman was crying in front of me, and I just felt so much compassion. It wasn't her pain. It was the pain. It was just pain. There was just pain in the room. And my heart was as compassionate towards that as it would be towards anything. My heart was very clear and open in that, you know, doing a lot of practice. It's not someone else's pain. If we're around the pain, it's pain. It's just pain. It's not, you know, someone else's. We are empathic beings. So, you know, this is very much the Buddhist view, is that we... when we harm other people, we are harming ourselves because we're not separate from their pain. If our heart is open, we can't be separate from it. This is really different than the way our society is. I mean, evolution tells us, you know, we're just all individual, trying to get our genes into the next generation. That's really why we're here. And, you know, it's... nature red in tooth and claw, some poet, Tennyson maybe, you know, that it's just the survival of the fittest, and capitalism tells us it's all about, like, enlightened self-interest. If everyone is just really selfish, the system really works. You know, we don't live in a culture that's very savvy about, you know, how connected we all are. So it's hard to hold this, but, you know, we see it through our practice. When we drop all of our stories about everything, it's not her pain, my pain. There's just pain, and I'm going to feel it as if it were mine. So regarding ethical behavior, the Dalai Lama says, why not make people's happiness your happiness? It'll increase your chances by 6 billion to 1. Again, the heart doesn't distinguish. If someone's happy, we can just be happy that someone's happy. It feels good. The Buddha has a whole practice on this called sympathetic joy, where we just simply orient to the happiness in the world and say, right on, yay, I'm glad somebody's happy. May you always be this happy. That's actually the practice, pretty much. So we're not separate. Our hearts get gladdened when we see happiness, and our hearts feel sad when we're with sad, someone else's sadness. So again, the more we orient to this, the more we can't really want to harm, you know? So I want to just say, those are some basic principles. There's a fifth principle that I don't really have time to unpack much, but it's basically that most of our happiness comes internally. But, I mean, certainly external circumstances are important. But, you know, materially, I mean, a lot of studies on this, once people cross a certain threshold financially, making more money doesn't make people any happier. I mean, and that threshold's pretty low. Once the basic needs are taken care of, you know, a lot of our happiness comes from our attitude and what we do with our minds. So that, again, means then we want to take a lot of care with what we do with our mental energy. The more we benefit, the happier we are inside. There's a Buddhist story that illustrates how our ethical actions shape our mind is critical. A king who had no sons put on a contest to see who could earn the right to be his successor. He challenged people to steal a horse without anyone in the kingdom knowing about it. Person after person brought him a horse, and he rejected them every time. No matter how convincing the robbers' stories sounded of their midnight escapades, the king knew they were all wrong. Finally, a man entered the king's court without a horse and told the king that his request was impossible because the robber would always know that they had stolen a horse. This man won the throne. We can never get away with a negative action because at least one person will always know about it, the transgressor. Buddhism talks about anger as being like wanting to hit someone with a hot rock, but you have to pick it up to throw it at the person. Our negative actions are similar. They burn our own hearts. This is an important basis for ethical action. I just want to talk briefly about the precepts, and then we'll end with some practice. So the precepts, again, remember that monks and nuns have more than 200. We only have 5 for lay people, but they're very significant. And I'll just read them to you. I undertake the training not to kill other sentient beings. I undertake the training not to take what is not given. I undertake the training not to harm others through sexuality. I undertake the training not to speak what is not true. I undertake the training not to use intoxicants to the point of carelessness. So, you know, most simply, don't kill, don't steal, don't harm people with your sexuality, don't lie, and don't harm yourself with drugs. You know, don't use drugs to the point of being stupid. Now, these are big. And I'm going to email the list a practice around taking one of these precepts this week and just working with it and kind of going deep with it if you wish. You know, for instance, the precept around not taking what's not given. So there's the outright material stealing, but there's many other ways we can orient to that. Maybe it's not like getting in someone's space when you sense they might need a little, you know, breathing room. We can really unpack these. But the idea here, the language, as you heard, is I undertake the training. This is these are practices. These are not thou shalt not or else you will end up in hell, right? These are not judgments of yourself. I'm helping Johann lead one of his groups, and we did the precepts last week, and so I was working with speaking truthfully. And by the way, that precept is to speak truthfully when it's useful to speak truthfully. You're not going to just blather your truth to, like, any random person, right? But, you know, that's a great one to work with, and I was working with it. And I see the little ways I shade the truth. And every time I would see that, I would realize in some way I was either trying to avoid conflict or trying to get somebody to like me. And so, you know, I just little shades of nothing big, blatant, but like, oh. And so what that did, rather than make me feel bad about myself, it made me feel like, oh, well, I know the remedy. The remedy is just a little metta for this guy right here. You know, a little self-love. And that you know, I know that makes me less focused on what other people think of me. So just working with that precept really helped me, rather than being judgmental of myself, being kinder to myself. So the encouragement would be to take up the practice of one of these, and let it be like a mindfulness bell for you. The idea here is not to emphasize restraint, deprivation. The idea is curiosity, interest. Huh, what's going on? What is my mind state where I'm about to shade the truth? Or I'm about to take something that's not given. What's my mind state? And the invitation is to let mindfulness take care of the mind state. Really let this be like a mindfulness bell. Okay, oh, I'm feeling desire. Huh, what's it like to be in a state of desire? What are the sensations? What are the thoughts? What are the images? And then let mindfulness take care of it. Stay with it. Just keep feeling the desire. Desire comes and goes. And it's gotta have that. Now, I don't like sitting with this. Of course. That's how it'll be. Something like that. But you can do it. And you will be protecting yourself from remorse, someone else from pain. You won't have to revisit that on your meditation cushion. And you can rejoice in the protection that you've provided somebody. And so it's the precept to kind of wake us up, but the mindfulness to actually really support us in being with the state. We act out our mental states in order to solve the mental states. I would reach for the thing that's not given because I don't want to feel my desire, because I believe that I have to have the thing for my desire to go away. It's not true. I can be with it with mindfulness. And if I stay interested, curious, observant, desire is impermanent, just like everything. And it can take care of itself. So I'll send that to you in a much more condensed email. And just have fun. Let it be an act of care and love, not deprivation. So any questions, comments?
I was just reminded of when you were talking about how we're all one, and with the laughter, just feeling joy. Like when somebody just starts laughing and you don't even know why, it just makes you feel like laughing.
Yes.
It's kind of contagious.
Yes. So the comment is that laughter is very contagious, like, and I'll just add, like everything. But laughter is a good one to remember. It's just a really good example of how we're all doing this together.
Can you give the same talk to a group of individuals who maybe have a big disconnect between guilt, themselves and guilt and remorse, and others?
Sociopaths?
Yeah.
That would be a hard one.
That would be a tough one.
Because sociopaths are known for being non-empathic. That's one of the definitions of it. So it would be very, very tough. And with that kind of person, they can be very intuitive about knowing what you want to hear while having no idea what it's like to be you. That's the lack of empathy. And yet they can fool people very easily because it's like they can read your mind, but they can't read your heart. So I don't know. That's an interesting one. Yeah, that would be very, you know, just to say, usually there's tremendous trauma underneath that kind of lack of empathy. So, again, a deeply, deeply challenging person who could maybe be doing very harmful things, but very likely that person way down deep is in a world of hurt. Good question. Everybody has Buddha nature. Whether it gets fixed or not, I don't know. But it potentially, yes. Okay, so we'll end with just 6-7 minutes of practice.